Torah is a tree of life
to those who hold on to it,
to those who grasp onto the Torah.
Says the Alkut Shimoni on Mishlei in Remez 834, Taftaf Kufla Medalet, that when the Tuposok here means Etz Chaim Ula Machazikimba, it is referring to the Etz Chaim that was in the Garden of Eden. We know that all the trees in the Garden of Eden were trees bearing fruit. And we know that specifically about Etz Chaim. How do we know that on Etz Chaim? When man was banished from Gan Eden, Hashem put the two krovim with la tacherva mitapechet, with some spiritual sword, to guard Etz Chaim. Why? The Torah tells us, Hashem did not want man to eat from the fruit of Etz Chaim and to live forever. So we can specifically see from the Torah that Etz Chaim, the tree of life, was a tree bearing fruit. So the Torah that is represented by the tree of life is represented by a fruit tree. So we can see that fruit trees represent the two most important things, Torah and man. Why they're the two most important things? Because without those things, the world would not exist. Torah. The Gemara says in Maseches Psochim, on the 68th page, in the name of Rabbi Eliezer, if it wasn't for Torah, the world would be destroyed. Im lo briti yomam v'layla, chukot shamayim v'aret lo samti. Which means that without the Torah, the world would not exist. And man, the Pasuk says in Yeshayahu, lo tohu bira'a leshevet yetzara. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world that man would sit in the world, that man would possess the world. Without man, there's no reason for the world to exist. So we can see that the fruit trees represent the two most important things in the creation, that without them, we wouldn't have any reason for the creation to be. So now we can start understanding what's the importance of Tu B'Shevat, which is Rosh Hashanah for fruit trees. We're talking about deep spiritual ideas here. And that's also why in the Hasidic world, Tu B'Shevat was always an extremely special date. And normally it is a time where in many Hasidic courts, they used to have the most spectacular ceremonies, the most spectacular meals, the deepest divrei Torah were given on this day. Because this day is not just a day where you just put a bunch of fruit on your table and you, pardon me for the expression, you pig out on some fruit. That's not the purpose of the day. The purpose is to realize that this is something spiritual. What does the fruit tree represent? And from there also we can understand what's the importance of the Seder Tu B'Shevat. You were given out these small sheets with the whole order of the Seder Tu B'Shevat. What's the purpose of this Seder Tu B'Shevat? The purpose is to instill in us some very important aspects that are very important that we pass them on to the next generation, to our children, that we pass them on to our families and to our wives. Now, what are the important things that we can learn about on Tu B'Shevat? One, the love for Eretz Yisrael. Tu B'Shevat, as a halachic festival, the ramifications are mostly in Eretz Yisrael. This is a wonderful opportunity for us to be able to instill into our family how important Eretz Yisrael is, how holy Eretz Yisrael is. One of the Midrashim here says that when Moshe Rabbeinu heard that he was not going to go into Eretz Yisrael, says the Midrash, he ripped his beard. He pulled out the hairs from his head. He was in mourning. Why? Moshe Rabbeinu said, I will not get to step in Eretz Yisrael. I won't get to eat the holy fruit of Eretz Yisrael, do the special mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu himself, that was Moshe Rabbeinu's sorrow, was that he was not going to go into Eretz Yisrael. We here are all lucky. And you, our viewers on the internet, who are not yet living in Eretz Yisrael, it's about time. So, think about it. And maybe it would be a good idea to come here for Tu B'Shevat. You still have two more days. No problem, you can make a quick flight. And anyone here, I'm sure, will put you up. We'll make sure that if you want to be here with us for Tu B'Shevat, we'll take care of you here at the Chuch El Chesed Kehila. Get moving. We live in Eretz Yisrael. We're lucky. The holy country, the holy land. We're walking 2 new meters. Dalet Amos is mitzvah. You're making a mitzvah just by walking in Eretz Yisrael. The fruits here are holy fruit. We have mitzvahs here that don't exist anywhere else. This is a time to teach our children how holy Eretz Yisrael is. The Gemara at the end of the tractate Yevomos, at the end of the 112th page and the beginning of the second side of that page, the Gemara tells how the Amoraim respected and loved Eretz Yisrael so much so, the Gemara there says that Rabbi Chanina used to take a big shovel, and he used to make sure that the roads leading to Eretz Yisrael, that the roads were clear, taking out all the stones. Why? Says Rashi, so that no one should come and say anything bad about Eretz Yisrael, saying, oh, you know, look at these roads. Now, unfortunately, many people here that live in Eretz Yisrael, when it comes to the roads issue, they have a bit of a problem. We like to blame Matz, which is the organization responsible for building those roads. See, one of the most wonderful things about going every single year to Uman is that we have to take a 3-hour drive from Kiev to Uman. And there you learn the big difference about the Ukrainian roads and the Israeli roads. And you learn how wonderful the Israeli roads are. There are no holes. I mean, there are rifts inside the Ukrainian roads. It's wonderful. Rabbi Hanina used to make sure that the roads in Eretz Yisrael were clear so that no one would bump his leg onto a stone and complain about Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, when they taught their Talmidim outside, in the field, when it was hot, they used to move them to somewhere with shade. When it was cold, they moved them to somewhere that was sunny and warm. Why? So their Talmidim shouldn't complain about Eretz Yisrael. Think how important it is. I once heard from the great Gaon, Rav Avigdor Nevenzel Shlita, the Rav of the Old City, something which in my ideas is very basic. And in my family, Baruch Hashem, my family have learned this from a very young age. I teach this to my children. Rav Nevenzel said, a person who treats Eretz Yisrael as the holy land, as the land of Hashem, how can he eat something and throw the paper wrapping on the floor? Tell me, would you go to the White House, and if you were offered there a sweet, take the sweet and take the paper and just plonk it on the floor in the White House? I highly doubt it. And remember who's sitting in the White House, right? Okay? You'd never do that. That's complete disrespect. You wouldn't do that in the White House. If your child would sit in your house and have a toffee or a sweet and take the paper and just go and plonk it, your reaction would be, pick it up now. Why? We'd never allow to go in our house. But never so said it's the same thing about Eretz Yisrael. If this is the holy land, this is the land of Hashem, how can you throw things on the ground of Eretz Yisrael? My children have learned from a very young age that any kind of garbage is thrown into the dustbin. It's not thrown on the floor. There's no such thing as throwing anything on the floor. And my children many times say to me, but Daddy, I mean, look at the floor. Other people have thrown things. I said, yes, and they're going to have to answer to Hashem. Why did they do that? But we don't throw anything. Tu B'Shvat is a wonderful opportunity for you to instill in your children and family the importance and holiness of Eretz Yisrael, of how much of a zchus we have that we live here in Eretz Yisrael, how we've got to pray that all the Jews will come to Eretz Yisrael and then Mashiach will come to Eretz Yisrael. Tu B'Shvat is also a wonderful opportunity for us to cause our children to appreciate the world of nature. When you think about it, fruit are the most wonderful candies that Hashem could have created. No sugar. Well, at least no what's called industrial sugar. No artificial coloring. I don't know what's called tartazine. You know, they in Israel, they have here a sauce which is called a Thousand Islands. In Israel, it's translated as Rotev Elef Ha'iyim. And they say as a joke, Elef Hayim are what most foods are represented today. They all have in them 1,000 E's. E111, E112, E I don't know what, E yellow, E sunset. It's a wonderful thing, an apple. You go to the tree, you can pick an apple, clean it up, make a brocha, and eat an apple. Nutritious, beautiful, tasty, delicious, healthy. This is a time to cause our children to appreciate nature, to say thank you to Hashem that we have such wonderful things. Most times, we see that as something mundane and accepted. I mean, you have fruit, you have an apple, you have a banana. Have we ever thought about the incredible wisdom in one banana? How it's guarded from the outside? How the yellow color is supposed to attract us and to cause us to have some appetite for the actual fruit? We can continue on and on. Tu B'Shvat is also a wonderful opportunity for us to teach our family some of the most important halachas that we deal with on a day-to-day basis that most of us are not well-versed in. Hilchos brachas. We're now having all these different fruits on the table. We've got to make all these different blessings on them. What do we make a blessing on each thing? What do we do the blessing first? What's the order? We have now a banana and an apple. What do we bench first? On the apple, boya pri ha'etz. On the banana, boya pri ha'adama. Okay, that might be a simple one. Boya pri ha'etz is more important. We have now an apple which is a very beautiful fruit, but not one of the seven species that Eretz Yisrael is blessed with, and we have a date, which is one of them. Eretz Zavat Chalav U'Dvash. Dvash is Dvash Tmarim, the honey that comes out from dates. You have here a date and an apple. What do you bench on first? It's a wonderful opportunity for us to learn a bit about Hilchos Brachos and to teach our children the basics of Hilchos Brachos. It's a wonderful opportunity, Seder Tu B'Shevat, to allow us to instill whatever we want to do with our children concerning Eretz Yisrael, concerning thanking Hashem, concerning Hilchos Brachos. But we have to prepare. We have to make sure that we come to the Seder Tu B'Shevat prepared, knowing what we're going to do. You see, unfortunately, no one here in the room has got the gift that Moreinu Rabbeinu Rosh HaYeshiva or Rav Shlita has. Rav Avraham Shlita has not got the gift. He doesn't have to prepare anything. He comes and Hashem is like, it's as if there's this like, I don't know what you call it, a Blu-ray beam that beams out from the sky and just like implants in his head what he's got to speak about at that moment, and he just goes for it. We don't get to do that. We have to be prepared. You have to come to Tu B'Shevat prepared. How are you going to build a Seder? You have children, you've got to make sure that you have a beautiful story about Eretz Yisrael or something about fruit to tell them. How do you build a Seder? Make sure that you have an interesting Dvar Torah. A Chiddush. The purpose of the Seder is to help us to plan it in a proper way. You've also got to plan the meal. This year it works out on the Shabbos. And halachically, the best thing to do it when it works out on the Shabbos is to do the Seder Tu B'Shevat in the meal. In other words, don't eat, then make Birkas HaMazon and then do the Seder Tu B'Shevat. While you're eating, you can start with the Seder Tu B'Shevat. The best thing would be, in my opinion, to do it at the beginning of the meal. And do you know why? Because normally once you get to the end of the meal, the thought of stuffing some more fruit into your belly is not appetizing, and that's an understatement. Start it at the beginning. It will also be much easier for your wife. They'll have to cook much less this Shabbos, because after you eat all the 15 kinds of fruits that you should try and get here, and again, you don't have to, you can try. Already, it makes it into, you're already full, you're already stuffed, so she doesn't have to cook that much. You've got to plan how the Seder is going to look. You've got to go out to some nice store and get these little dishes, even chad pami, something to make the table look nice. Maybe a nice tablecloth with an imprint of some fruit or something green. Plan it. Make sure that for your children, Tu B'Shevat is a wonderful experience. The minhagim that on Tu B'Shevat, which is, by the way, the birthday of Rabbi Natan, that was the day Rabbi Natan was born on Tu B'Shevat, so it's also a special date for us, Chassidei Breslev. On Tu B'Shevat, there is a minhag that we read together all the 15 chapters in Tehillim of Shir HaMalos. They appear in every single Siddur, in every single Ashkenazi Siddur. You'll find them at Shabbos Mincha. After the Mincha davening, you'll find all the 15 Shir HaMalos, because there's a minhag of saying them during the winter times. We can say all the Shir HaMalos together, say Tehillim on the table. And all those Tehillim are filled with beautiful psukim. Prepare yourselves. Make sure that Tu B'Shevat is a wonderful ceremony which your children will remember for the rest of their lives. So far, that was the introduction on how to plan the Tu B'Shevat Seder. What is the purpose of the Tu B'Shevat Seder? And especially here we live in Eretz Yisrael. We can use that to instill into our children how lucky we are that we're here in Eretz Yisrael. And I'm talking here especially from those of us who have made Aliyah and come from abroad, because normally, most people who lived in Chutz La'aretz had a better financial life in Chutz La'aretz. They did. Money there was better. Panosa there was better. For most people. One of the problems, for example, that we have, Bezat Hashem, in 2 weeks' time, I'm flying to South Africa. I'm going to give there a series of shiurim also. South Africans have got a serious problem and a difficulty of coming here to Eretz Yisrael, because in South Africa, the cost of living is much easier. Every single South African Jewish woman has got a black maid in her house, which does most of the housework. Now, convince her to come to Eretz Yisrael and start doing all the washing and cleaning and everything on her own. It's difficult. Many people here had a better financial life in Chutz La'aretz. But nevertheless, I don't think that anyone had a better spiritual life in Chutz La'aretz. A very good friend of mine, his father is considered to be the top allergist expert. He's the head of the medical facility in Ashdod, here in Eretz Yisrael. He was a doctor coming from St. Louis, and he told me once I spoke to him, he said that even though here he makes a very nice parnos, he's considered to be a very chosh of a doctor, he made in Chutz La'aretz at least 5 times more in his private clinic. And I said to him, so why did you come here to live in Eretz Yisrael? And you know what he said to me? He said, I wanted all my children to be married to Jews. And in Chutz La'aretz, I can't guarantee that. And he says, Baruch Hashem, I have five children, all from, all good, all God-fearing Yidden, all married to from Jewish girls or boys, and that have built wonderful Jewish families. And that's my nachas here. And he said, that's why I came here to Eretz Yisrael. And so those are things that you can use the Tu B'Shvat Seder to instill within your family, to appreciate the fact that you were lucky to make Aliyah, to live here in Eretz Yisrael. Nachon, it might be a bit more difficult and a bit more hectic. And there's certain things that aren't the way they used to be in America. But spiritually, you can't even compare it. There's nowhere else that a Jew can live freely like a Jew than here in Eretz Yisrael. I sometimes finish here, yeshiva, I finish work at about 3, 4 a.m. I walk home at night, 3, 4 a.m. Has there ever been a problem walking here at 3 or 4 a.m. in Eretz Yisrael going home? Has anyone ever said to me something about me being Jewish? I walk freely home. It's a 15-minute walk. In America, can you do that? In many places, you can't do that. In England, my relations in England are petrified of walking in the streets of London looking like Jews because of all the Muslim anti-Semitism there. He's got to wear a cap on his head. And if they walk, they normally walk a bunch of Jews, 10, 15 Jews together. Here in Eretz Yisrael, we just take it for granted. 2, 3 o'clock at night, you could just walk around. It's a wonderful bracha in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, here we can be Yidden the way we want to be and work Hashem. And this is a time to teach our family how to appreciate the fact that we had the zchus of living here in Eretz Yisrael. And not just not referring to all the spiritual aspects of living in Eretz Yisrael. So these are all the things that we can use the Tu B'Shvat Seder to instill within our families. And now that we've finished this introduction about what the purpose of the Tu B'Shvat Seder is, we're going to start speaking about some of the halachas of eating the Tu B'Shvat fruit. And mostly we're going to be dealing today with the problem of fruit that are infected by different worms or insects, etc. Why do we have today such an influx in the problem of all these mazikim, of all these tola'im, the worms and the insects in fruits? So there are many scientific explanations. One of them says, since we're importing many fruits, we're also importing all the different insects that come from abroad. You see, you have now the American worm, the European worm, the Asian worm. Another reason says that because we use so much what's called chomrei adbara, we use so much chemicals trying to make sure that the fruit will grow properly, we're creating a new species of insects which are able to cope with everything that we attack them with. They have immunity. All those reasons are nice, but that's not the real reason. The real reason is brought in our Parshas Shavua and our Chaim HaKadosh. In our Parshas Shavua, Parshas Beshalach, it is the Parsha of the man. Hashem brought down the holy food from the sky, the food of the angels. Lechem abirim achal ish, says the Midrash. That is the food of the angels, the holy food, the man. The man came down every single day. But the man had certain stipulations. You can't keep the man from one day to the next. Why? Because one of the most important purposes of the man was to teach Am Yisrael bitochen. Learn how to trust in Hashem. Every single day He will give you what you need to eat. Don't try storing your food from one day to the next, thinking maybe tomorrow won't have it. Doesn't work that way. Says the Torah, there were some people, some very, very evil people known as Datan and Aviram, which we have a long history with them in the whole story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. They decided they're not going to trust Hashem. They kept their man for the next day. What happened? Says the Torah, Vayarum tola'im vayivash. It became filled with worms, and the food became spoiled. Says Or HaChaim HaKadosh, Vayivash, the Unklus explains the word Vayivash comes from the words Ra and Bish, two words representing something evil. Says Or HaChaim HaKadosh, when do the worms come? The worms come when a man disrespects Torah and mitzvahs. That is the word Vayivash. Worms are a spiritual meter for us to know, are we going the right way or the wrong way? In other words, what Rav Chaim HaKadosh is saying, that the more sins that we make, the more worms we will find in our foods. Never before have we as Yidden had to cope with what the world is throwing at us than in this era. It is so difficult to be a God-fearing Jew today. Look at the media, the press, the anti-Semitism, all the anti-Jewish, all the anti-Jewish outlooks. Everything, we are attacked from every single direction, trying to convince us to leave Hashem Chas v'Chalila and adopt the Western society. Adopt all the terrible things that the Western world has got to offer. I heard once from the great Gaon Rav Ovadia Yosef Shlita that he said that a Jew in this time and era that is able to keep the Torah and the mitzvahs will get a better sachar than one of the Jews that lived in the times of the Tannaim and sat and learnt every day, because they didn't have to cope with what we had to cope with. We live in a time filled with sins, filled with taivas. So obviously, since this is the way the world is, there are obviously going to be more worms. There's going to be more insects, more infestations affecting our food. So therefore we can see that the whole point of tola'im, of worms and insects affecting our foods, is something spiritual, not something physical. And that is the true explanation why we have a bigger problem today than our fathers and our grandparents had 100 years ago. Because 100 years ago, the world was a much easier place to live in from a Jewish point of view. It wasn't that difficult as it is today. There weren't iPhones, and there wasn't internet, and there wasn't these massive, big, non-sneeristic adverts that you just walk in the street and... It didn't exist. One of the most important halachas concerning fruit is that fruits that are susceptible to be infected with worms or other insects, you are not allowed to eat them before you open them up. Let's take, for example, a date. We know in halacha there's a big inyan of eating something whole. You're not allowed to eat a whole date before you open it up. How do you check a date? You take the date, and you take a knife, or with your fingers, if you prefer the less delicate way, you take a knife, and you slice it in half until you reach the actual pip, the core inside. You open the date, you take the pip out, and you look to see if everything is clean inside the date. Normally when we have a problem with worms, they tend to bore inside the date and hide under the pip. So you take the pip, you make sure the date is whole, there's no part there that's black or that's rotting. And if everything looks okay, we're not finished yet. You hold the date up to a source of light, because sometimes the infestation can be on the outside part of the date. So when you look at the date itself, the color of a normal date, I'm talking now about dry dates, not about fresh dates, is brownish, light to dark brownish. It is still transparent enough that if you hold it up to a light source, you'll be able to see if there's anything black or anything that looks as if it shouldn't be part of the date. So if you look it up to the light source, you can see that everything's more or less clear. Or if you see something, you can see it's part of the date. Only then can you eat the date. And even though it's not as whole as it used to be before, it is more important to make sure that the date is clean than to make sure you make the blessing on a whole date. Why? If a person now goes, this is a bit of a difference that most people don't know about the whole issa about eating insects. Every single insect that you eat, if it is an insect that crawls on the ground like a worm, one insect is worth 5 loving. In other words, one insect is like eating 5 portions of pork. And if it's a flying insect, like a fly or a mosquito, etc., it's 6 lavim. It's like eating 6 portions of pork. What does that mean? Let's explain it. Why is a flying insect more? A flying insect is another posuk that tells us about not eating shelet ta'of. So therefore the Gemara in Maseches Makos on the 15th page of the second side learns that Sheret Tza'of has got 6 lavim, unlike Sheret Tza'aretz, who crawls on the ground, only has 5. Now what does that mean? You're invited to somewhere where the kashrus is problematic. It's kosher, but it's not the kosher that we eat. We still need to eat there because someone close invited us, and if we don't eat, he will be highly, highly insulted, and we didn't find a way to get out of it. And he offers you to eat 2 things. He brings you a beautiful steak with rice. Normally most people would say, okay, I'll eat the rice, I won't eat the steak. I mean, I don't know where the meat came from. Is it mahadrin, not mahadrin? How is the shechita? Wrong. You eat the steak, you don't eat the rice. Why? If the rice was not checked properly, And normally, in a restaurant, checking rice is not an easy thing. The rice is very probably infected. Which means that if you eat one spoon of rice and you had one insect, that is 5 or 6 transgressions that you've made with one little teaspoon. The steak itself is most probably kosher. Might not be mahadrin. And even if it's not kosher, eating the steak, you've got to eat a kazait, which is 27 grams for only one transgression. Which means one portion of steak is much less than one spoon of rice. So therefore, rice is much more problematic than meat, than fish, or than chicken. Fish is also problematic because many fish are also infected with worms. So if you have the choice between meat and fish, most people will say, I'll take fish. Wrong. You take meat. Because meat doesn't normally have a worm problem, unless we're talking about meat that was left out and therefore became infected because it wasn't dealt with properly, something which is normally not common in today's industrial world where we have relatively high standards of food. So if we have the choice between meat and fish, you take meat, you don't take fish. You have the choice between meat and a lettuce salad, you don't touch the lettuce salad. You have the meat. We start now realizing how problematic the whole issue, the halachic issue, of insects is. It is considered to be much more severe. You have a choice. Eat an ant or eat pork. Most people think, oh, pork, oh, no, I'm not touching that. I mean, there's a limit. Wrong. If you're forced to eat pork or an ant, you eat pork. Pork is 1 issa. An ant is 5. 5 times worse, eating one little teeny bitty witty little ante than eating one big portion of pork. So that means we need to know what fruits are problematic and how are we supposed to check fruits. So let's start talking about the common fruits and the common different pitzuchim that we might have here in Eretz Yisrael and where the problems. First one, pistachio. Fistuk. Fistuk is, the bracha on a fistuk is boya pri ha'etz, it grows on a tree. Very problematic. Why is it very problematic? The outer shell of the pistachio nut, am I saying it right? Is that how? The outer shell of a pistachio nut, whenever you get it, it is always open. Which means the insects do not have to make a very difficult effort to eat the pistachio. Normally, when you take something that's closed, let's take, for example, an almond, a whole nut. A whole nut which is closed, the insect has got to bore through the outer shell in order to get to the fruit inside. And you will normally be able to see it if you can see their holes on the outer shell. With the pistachios, it doesn't have to make any effort. It's open. It's as if it's got a big neon sign there saying, please come in and eat me. That's part of the fruit, which means pistachios are very problematic. How do we check them? We take away the peel, and we look at the nut itself. If everything looks good, and everything looks whole, and we can see that there's no crumbs inside the actual shell, when you normally see crumbs inside, you've got to start thinking, what is going on here? A fruit normally doesn't crumble. It doesn't leave some crumbs in the outer shell. Crumbs are normally a sign that something has been eaten or nibbled here. Why? If you take, for example, a drill, and you drill through a plaque of wood or through a wall, what normally happens? The wood, you will have all these remains of pieces, shards of wood, or parts of the wall, cement. Why? That's what happens when you bore through something. When the worm bores through the nut, it leaves some crumbs on the outer shell. So when you see crumbs, you've got to start thinking, what's going on here? If you see crumbs on the outer shell, you have to open the pistachio in half to make sure that it's clean. If it's clean, you can eat it. If the pistachio is completely whole, there's no problem, it doesn't look shriveled or a weird color, you're allowed to eat it without even opening it. But, halachic suggestion, all the poskim say, it is preferable to take 10% of what you're about to eat, open 10%, to do what's called a statistic checkup. If you, for example, now have 100 pistachios, take 10, open 10 of them. If all 10 are clean, you can eat all the other 90 without even checking them, unless, of course, one of them looks suspicious to you. For example, even if you checked 10%, and now you take a pistachio, which is beautiful and has a massive hole in the middle, no, you're not allowed to eat it without opening it. Because even though you did a statistic check, this pistachio is already outside of the statistic range. You have to open it up. But if everything looks whole and good, you did a statistic check of 10%, you don't have to open the rest of the pistachios. Nuts. Most of us, when we get nuts today, we get already peeled nuts. You get them in packets that come in about 100 grams, 200 grams. Now, those gnats have on them a kashrus of sometimes the best kashriot, the best badatsim, but that's the Haredis, but that's Rav Rubin, etc. What is the problem with all these things? Because the kashrus is not on worms. Most fruits are infected in two main areas, either on the tree or in the warehouses. On the tree, we have what's called natural insects, that their food is the fruit of the tree. Normally today in the industrial world, there are very, very few natural insects on the tree itself. Why? Because all the farmers do not want to have any insects on their produce. It kills their produce, they lose money. So what they use is, they use different chemicals to make sure that all these different insects will be deterred from coming to the trees, and they kill them. So normally on the tree itself, we will not find many insects in industrial growth. The problem comes after the farmer sells it to the importer or to the exporter. All these different things are taken into massive warehouses and left there open for a certain amount of time. Sometimes it can be half an hour, sometimes it can be a day, sometimes with things that can last for much longer, it can even be weeks. Now, they don't take every single fruit and wrap it in silver foil or in a standard wrapping and put it separately, because then they'd never end their job. They just pour them into massive big containers that are left open in most places. That is a feast for insects. They don't even have to make an effort. Just come to the warehouse and pick your food. Which means we have many warehouse insects. Now, imagine now the nuts. We have here this massive container containing, let's say, about 5,000 kilos or 5,000 liters of nuts. And we're now taking it to the factory where these nuts are bagged. It's very possible that an insect which flew onto one of the nuts, bore into one of the nuts, was bagged together with the nuts. So even if you get a packet of nuts which are peeled with kashrus, that doesn't mean they don't have any worms. How do we check these packets? You hold a packet and you look at the bottom to see if you can see any crumbs at the bottom of the packet. Again, they're not supposed to be crumbs. If there are crumbs, which normally happens, why? Because the process of peeling the nuts also causes some shards themselves in the nuts to remain. You look at the crumbs. If the crumbs look to you all natural as part of the nut, that's fine. But if you see webbing, some webbing inside the actual packet, or if you see some pieces which do not look to you like part of the nut, that means that you have to open this packet and you have to check every single nut separately to make sure that everything is fine. If you hold the packet up and there's no crumbs whatsoever, or even if there are crumbs, you can see that all the crumbs are parts of the nuts themselves, that's fine, you're allowed to eat that packet, you don't have to do anything. Again, preferable if you want to make a statistic check. Take a couple of nuts, take a look, make sure that everything is clean. Cashew. Oh, here we're coming to a big problem. Cashew, to understand, where does a cashew come from? Cashew grows normally in Asia, in the area of mostly of East Asia. That's where it originated from. If anyone saw a cashew tree, he'd be fascinated. The cashew tree is actually some sort of apple tree, which the apple is completely poisonous and you can't eat the apple. On top of the apple, we have as if this crown, which the crown is combined of the different shells of the cashew. Now, the cashew in its natural form is a very, very poisonous fruit. Which means if a person or an animal, animals don't touch that fruit. If they eat it, they die. The only way to make a cashew, the only way to make it edible is by drying it, peeling it, frying it. It's a whole big process until the cashew nut is actually ready to eat. The cashew nut has a bit of a problem with the way it grows from our point of view, which is the halachic point of view of insects. And that is, on the wide part, it looks a bit like a rounded banana. The edge is thin and then it becomes thicker. In many cashews, at the thick edge, where the two parts combine, there's a little hole which allows the insect to go straight into the cashew nut without even making any effort. That's the way it grows. There are cashews that come completely closed and therefore you'd be able to see if something bore into them. There are cashews that look a bit like this, slightly open, which means the insect doesn't even have to make an effort to go into them. Now, what does that mean about cashews? Cashews are one of the most infected fruits that we know of, not because of what happens on the tree, because of what goes on in the warehouses. Just like we like cashews, so do the insects love the cashew nuts. They're very tasty, expensive, and tasty. What does that mean about checking cashews? First of all, every single cashew that has a hole at the wide end, a natural hole, you have to open it up and make sure that it is fine, there's nothing inside it. The closed cashews, if they look whole, and you can see that there's no signs whatsoever of any boring or scraping or eating the cashew nut, you're allowed to eat them without checking them. Also here, very advisable, do a statistical checkup of 10%. Take the 10% of the cashew nuts, open them up, and make sure they have no worms. Now this, by the way, even though it might be a bit of an effort and a bit of a difficulty, this is a wonderful thing and a wonderful way to teach your children how a Jew is supposed to eat his food. Jews do not pounce on the food. They don't stuff their mouths with food. Before we eat anything, what do? We make a bracha. Before we eat anything, we make sure that it is edible from the halachic point of view. It's a wonderful way of teaching children how they should treat their food. We don't just pounce on the plate of the cashews. We take a cashew, we open it up, we check, we explain to the children what are we doing to teach them how to eat properly in the future. So that is cashews. Next thing, raspberries. There is no heter whatsoever for a frum Jew to eat that fruit. Why? Even though it is considered to be a delicacy in many places, the way the raspberry fruit is built, it is built of these small little balls concentrated around the main stem, which means this is heaven for any insect trying to eat and hide. He just crawls in between the balls, attaches himself to the stem, you can't even see him. It is virtually impossible to find insects in raspberries unless you peel them one by one and they don't crumble. Another example of something very, very difficult to find insects in is broccoli, for the same reason. The florets are so crowded together that the insects can just crawl inside them and you can't make sure that they're insect clean. That's why you are not allowed to eat broccoli unless it was grown in special methods and has on it a very, very good kashrus. I was asked a question about 3 weeks ago. A woman made a very, very big banquet. I think it was for the birth of one of her grandchildren. And she made this massive, massive big broccoli. I think it was a broccoli salad. I mean, we're talking here about a salad which is supposed to be for 60, 70 people. But she didn't buy a broccoli which was grown in special methods with a good kashrus. And she called me to ask me, what do I do? I said to her, you take the whole thing, you put it in a bag, and you throw it in a dustbin. She said, what? She said, do you know how much that cost me? I said, I'm really sorry, I said. That broccoli, it's not maybe that it's infected with insects. It's 100%. You're not allowed to eat it. You bought pork and mixed pork up in your broccoli salad. That's the way you should treat it. She lost hundreds of shekels there. There's no heter whatsoever to eat broccoli unless it has on it a good kashrus that it is insect clean. Because otherwise, you can't eat it, you can't check it. Same thing with, I don't know what it's called in English. In Hebrew, it's called korvit. Cauliflower. Oh, thank you. Cauliflower. Same thing with cauliflower. Same problem with cauliflower. More so, lettuce. You are not allowed to eat lettuce that doesn't come from a special growth. Why? Over the past 10 years, we have been introduced to a new insect, which is called, in Hebrew, tolat hamechilot, which is, we'd call it the tunnel worm. This is a worm that bores its way inside the actual stem of the lettuce, which means even after you clean the lettuce on the outside surface, you will not be able to see the worm. And unless you take it under an infrared light or an ultraviolet, I'm not so sure what kind of light, I think ultraviolet light, and make sure only then can you actually see through the actual base of the lettuce. Which means, and if you take a lettuce and you scrub it from all sides, it doesn't help to solve the problem of the boar worm. So you're not allowed to eat lettuce unless it comes from a growth that is insect clean. Again, this is just the reality. There's no heter. In yeshiva here, I was asked a question about 2 weeks ago. They got a donation, I think, of about 50, 60 lettuces, which is a very nice amount. If we'll say that each lettuce cost around the area of 5 shekel, we're talking about 250 shekel. They made a very big lettuce salad with tomatoes, with cucumbers, I don't know what else. The salad must be evaluated at least 300 to 400 shekel worth, not putting in the amount of time it took to cut up all these different vegetables. They asked me what to do with the salad. I said, where does the lettuce come from? They said, regular lettuce. I said, take the salad, bag it up, throw it in the dustbin. They said, what are the bochim going to eat? I said, I'm really sorry. There's nothing they can do. We'll distribute them among the people here of the Kehillah. You're not allowed to eat lettuce which doesn't come from a special growth. Now, there was a problem which the Rabbanut HaRashit spoke about over the past few months, which is the problem of what's called excessive use of chemicals in all the different vegetables that are grown on special growths insect-free. What does that mean? We have here in Israel at least 25 to 30 different companies which sell produce, for example, such as lettuce, cauliflower, broccoli, which are supposed to be insect clean. Only about 5 of them are actually supervised both by the European Council and by the Israeli Council of Fruit to make sure that they do not use too many chemicals. The other 20 to 25 are not supervised whatsoever. And they want to take the easy way out. How do they make sure that there's no insect? Very simple. They make sure that no life form whatsoever can live on the lettuce. They drown it with chemicals, which makes it very dangerous. There are companies, one of the best, what is considered to be today the company with the lowest amount of chemicals is the original company that started this whole concept of insect-free produce, which is Hasalat. And Hasalat have got a European, they're also supervised not only by the Israeli Council, but also by the European Council. Why? Anyone who ever went to visit by Hasalat will see that they invested hundreds and thousands of shekel in different instruments that make sure that it is insect cleaning, like this special vacuum cleaner, which is actually an insect vacuum cleaner. I think they're the only ones in Israel that have it. Why? They have no choice. Since they are supervised by the European Council, they're not allowed to use too many chemicals. So, there are certain companies that one is allowed to eat, certain companies that one should refrain from eating, not because of the halachic issue of insects, because of the halachic issues of pikuach nefesh, too many chemicals in them. It's just dangerous. Now, after the Rabbanut HaRashit came out with this, I'm assuming that within 6 months we'll see that all the companies will be supervised by the Israeli Council, simply because it's now a financial issue. Because they all want to have the supervision to make sure that other people will buy them. So far, there are a few companies that one can buy. Chasalat, Birkat Katif, Yevulim, those are considered to be supervised companies. There's no problem in buying them. They have... What? Chasalat. Chasalat have Chasalat, Yarok Minateva, Birkat Katif, and Yevulim. Those are 4 companies that we know that are supervised. We know that the level of chemicals there are very low. And again, there is no heter whatsoever to go to the market and buy lettuce, cauliflower, or broccoli from the market. Petrozilia, kusbara, shamir, no heter whatsoever. Refrain from eating them then. Just don't eat them. Don't spice your food. You're not allowed to buy those things. Those things are not maybe infected. They're 100% infected with insects. There's no heter whatsoever. It's like going and buying a packet of pork. We don't buy pork, we don't buy non-supervised vegetables. Kusbara, shamir, all the things that we can see that are grown insect-free. All those things are very, very problematic. Now, another thing, if you're really talking about it, even when we buy lettuce, or cauliflower, or broccoli from these good companies, if you'll notice, on all of them they have instructions on the outer packet saying, you have to wash them before use. Why does that say that? That is not a recommendation. That is a halachic stipulation. Why? Even though all these products are insect-free, nevertheless we have a problem with little flies that come and attach themselves to the actual flour during the process of packing. They're trying to prevent that, but it is something that is not controllable. Now, that means that in every single packet of lettuce, even in the best companies, they might be up to 2 little flies that merely attach themselves to the flies. What happened is, they were flying around while the fruit was bagged. It was bagged and wrapped up, and they just got caught in the bag. Now, you remove them just by simply washing them under a normal flow of water, but you have to wash these things before eating them. You're not allowed to just take it out of the bag, cut it up and eat it. Why? Because there's still a problem with these little flies. This has got nothing to do with the growth, it's insect-free, but It just while they're bagging them, they might just come in. So you have to follow the instructions written on the bags. It's not recommendations, it's stipulations. Yes?
Artichokes. I don't know how they're called in Hebrew.
Artichokes.
They're sort of like, they could be problematic like broccoli or cauliflower. Can you soak them in vinegar solution?
Artichokes are very, very problematic. For that reason, I have not eaten artichokes, I think, for over 15 years. The only part that you can eat of the artichoke is the actual, what's called the artichoke heart, which is the bottom part. The leaves themselves are very, very problematic. Corn. One's not allowed to eat corn on the cob. I don't know what it's called. I don't know what Americans call it. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Corn on the cob. You're not allowed to eat corn on the cob. Corn is extremely infected. Again, the insects just come in, crawl in between the different corns. The only way you're allowed to eat corn is corn in a can, or corn that was actually sliced off the cob and that was checked to make sure that it is clean. No heter whatsoever to eat corn on the cob. Now let's continue with the fruits that are problematic fruits. Okay? Banana chips. You all know the banana chips, those hardened banana chips. Even though there's no problem with insects about the banana chips, for the year 5773, the Badatz Eda Haredis came out saying that you're not allowed to eat the banana chips since they are all cooked by goyim. This is not a problem of insects, this is a problem of bishul goyim. Why? In Israel, even though we have here banana plantations, most, 95% of the bananas are meant either to be for the Israeli market as regular natural bananas, or they are exported abroad. Most of the banana chips that we get come from Chutz La'aretz, from non-Jewish factories, and the people that are working there are non-Jews. The banana chips go through a process of cooking. We know that according to the Ashkenazi Jews, according to the Ramah, in order for it not to be considered to be bishul akum, a bishul, cooking by goy, the Jew has to light the fire. Okay, that's relatively easy. But according to the Shulchan Aruch and according to the Sfarim, not only does the Jew have to light the fire, he's got to put the food on the fire. With the quantity they make there of banana chips, there's no way that there's going to be a Jew there putting all the banana chips on the fire and having them roasted. So the Badatz Eda Haredis came out this year and they wrote in their prospect, which they released this year for 5773, you're not allowed to eat banana chips because of Bishul Akum. Now, what happened in previous years, what's going to happen in following years, I don't know. I'm speaking about this year. This is what Badatz Eda Haveri says, do not eat banana chips. Next problem, dates. Okay. Dates are considered to be one of the most highly infected fruits that there exist. Why? One of the reasons is, especially in dry dates, a dry date has in it a little hole, a little entrance, allowing the worms to go in very easily. Dates are also considered to be very infected trees. Now, ripe dates, live dates or natural dates, are much easier to check than dry dates. How do you check live dates? In live dates, or in natural dates which are not dried, the worms are normally also live worms. You take the date, you open it up, you slice it in half, you unfold it so that all the particles of the date stick outside. What? In figs, sorry. Sorry. Figs, not dates. In figs. Again, I'm sorry, I'm talking about figs. You take out the part of the fig, and then you immerse it inside a cup of water or a bowl of water, glass, transparent. You put it in upside down. If there's a worm inside it, the first thing the worm's going to try and do, it's going to release itself from the fig and slowly swim up to the surface because it needs air to breathe. So you will be able to see if this fig is infected or not infected. That's good with natural figs. That is not good with dry figs. Dried figs, normally the worms are dead. They're dry. And not only that, worms inside figs look exactly like those small little particles, the knobs that come out of the figs themselves. Which means unless you know what you're looking for, you can't identify them. Someone brought me a fig, I have it upstairs in my office here. It has in it three worms. 95% of the people who I showed the fig to managed to find two. The third one, they couldn't find until I showed it to them. Figs are very difficult to eat. Therefore, refrain from eating dried figs. It's not worth it. With all due respect, when it comes to a bracha, we have a rule of sfeik brachot le'akel. When we have a doubt about a certain bracha, we never make the bracha because we're afraid of using Hashem's holy name in vain. Using Hashem's holy name in a bracha is a machloikis, whether it's an isur d'oraisa or drabonim. And even if it's an isur d'oraisa, it's one issa. Eating a worm inside a fig is five. So if we refrain from making a bracha from the fear that maybe, for some opinions, we are going to be doing an issur from d'oraisa, kal v'chomer that we should not eat figs. Those who nevertheless want to eat a fig for the kabbalic reason of eating figs on Tu B'Shvat, this is what I do. I take the fig, I open it up, I take a sharp knife, and I completely remove the whole part inside. All that's left is the outer skin. I take the skin, I wash it very well under water, and the skin is very easy to see if it's clean. I make the bracha, or I say the posuk, and I eat a small piece of the fig skin, and I'm yoitze, the kabbalic thing of eating figs on Tu B'Shvat. Refrain from eating figs. Impossible to check them if you don't know what you're looking for. Don't eat figs, it's not worth it. Strawberries. Oh, what that little red fruit has done to Am Yisrael. It's unbelievable how people have a lust for this little red vegetable, which is really considered to be from botanical thing a vegetable. All these different heterium of how to eat strawberries. Now, strawberries are very problematic. What's the problem with strawberries? Strawberries have on them many insects which can camouflage themselves very well. Some poskim say that if you're unable to see the insect, even though it's camouflaged, you're allowed to eat it. Most poskim completely dispute. Why? Because according to that logic, if I will take any one of you dressed like a normal Haredi man, clad in black, and I will tell you at night to put on a black bag on your head and stand at the side of the wall, I will not be able to see you either. That doesn't mean I'm allowed to eat you. If I go into the savannah and I see a zebra which has camouflaged itself very well, that doesn't mean I'm allowed to eat a zebra. Same true about other things. The problem with strawberries is not that you can't see the insects, it's that they camouflage themselves well. We went to the laboratory of Rav Shneur Zalman Revach Shlita, the head of the Institute of Amachon LeMitzvot HaKlurot Ba'aretz. We brought the strawberries. The strawberries that were cleaned, we'll explain certain how to clean them. After they clean them, they spread out, they put a netting underneath so we can see everything that was cleaned, and they put it on a table and let us check. In a quantity of 40 strawberries brought here from one of the Haredi shops, we found seven flies, about 20 little insects called trypses. Okay? We also found there about 9 or 10 spiders, not including all the eggs of other insects that we found. That is in 40 strawberries that we bought here in Shmuel HaNovi, in a Haredi store. Which means strawberries are highly infected. That doesn't mean you're supposed to refrain from eating strawberries. How do we eat strawberries? You take a strawberry and you cut the top part, the part with the green leaves. You cut that, it's impossible to clean it. You then take the strawberry and you take a soft brush. The soft brush can also be a toothbrush, which is soft, not medium. Those that are medium, hard kill the strawberries. You then rub each strawberry separately. Now, you don't have to rub it. We're not talking about, this is not Pesach, where you're trying to grind, okay? Or we're trying to grind the wheat. We're talking about rubbing it the way you should rub it. You rub it, you put it aside. Next one, you rub it all around, you put it aside. After you've finished rubbing them, you take all the clean strawberries, you put them in a bowl of water with soap inside the bowl, and leave them there for 3 minutes. Don't do it for too long, otherwise it will be saturated with soap and you will not be eating a strawberry. You will be eating soap stuffed inside a strawberry. Not very tasty. Then you're allowed to eat strawberries. You're not allowed to take a strawberry, wash it under the water and eat it. If you do that, it is not maybe that you will be eating any insects. It is 100% that you'll be eating any insects. And the fact that you're unable to see them doesn't mean that they're not there. It just means that they're hiding and you do not know what to look for. So that's the way to eat strawberries. Cut the top part, take each strawberry, rub it around with a small soft brush. Afterwards, put all the clean strawberries in a bowl of water, 3 minutes with soap. Then wash them, of course, under a flow of a running water, just that you can eat when you're not eating soap. You're allowed to eat strawberries. What? Inside of the strawberry. If the strawberry looks whole on the outside, and you can see, once you cut the top part, it is very simple to look at the strawberry. You look at the strawberry from all sides. You can see if anything is dug into the strawberry. Of course, if you can see a hole inside the strawberry, it looks as if something dug into that. Even if you clean it from the outside, you've still got to open the strawberry up to make sure that there's nothing inside it. We're talking about strawberries that look whole. Now, what that means is, if you are now going to the market and you are buying strawberries, try and buy the strawberries that look nice, fresh, a good coloring of red. Don't buy twin strawberries. And strawberries, many times you can find twin strawberries, which are two strawberries stuck together. Don't buy twin strawberries. Don't buy strawberries that have these weird shapes or these different enclaves inside the strawberry. It makes it very difficult to clean them. Get good shaped, nice looking strawberries. That normally means that they are less infected and much, much easier to clean. Questions so far about cleaning fruits? Yes? No, today, if you don't mind, we're continuing the share for a bit longer today because Rav Maimon is not here. The Gaon Rav Maimon is in Chutz in America, spreading the word of Hashem and the word of Rabbeinu. With the help of Hashem, he will be back here soon. So we have a bit more time. Please, let's try and dedicate the questions today only to the issue of checking fruits for Tu B'Shvat, if we can. Yes?
I know that people generally, in my gila, when they're washing strawberries, do what you said, but without the rubbing with a brush. That's still okay to eat, or better to not?
Is it allowed to wash the strawberries without the rubbing of the brush? Answer, no. All different researchers that have done have showed that unless you use a brush, you are not removing a large portion of the insect. Yes?
When it comes to jelly, any of these fruits that have been made into jelly,
okay. Very good question. What happens when it comes into jelly? The greatest issue about eating insects is while the insect is whole. Not whether the insect is alive or not, but while it's whole. For example, an ant that I plucked off one of its legs is not considered anymore to be a whole ant. The issue is called in halacha isur bria. Bria means a creation, something whole. The minute things have been ground, that means that even if there were any insects in them, the insects have now been shredded to little tiny weeny bits of pieces and you can't even find them. And what that also means is that we now have in this big jar of jam a very small minority of insects. Therefore, any one of these problematic fruits that has been made into jelly and has been completely ground, you're allowed to eat it. That means that in the quality jellies, where it is not ground, but you still have their pieces of the actual fruit themselves, there's no heter eating those. That's very problematic. Only if we're talking about the cheap jelly, which normally, by the way, in the cheap jelly, there's no strawberry whatsoever. No, there's no strawberry. There might be some strawberry essence, but there's no strawberry. So that already solves the problem. Yes? The size of the insects makes no difference. The only halachic stipulation is that you can see it with your naked eye. Which means if it's something so tiny and minute that you can only see it on a microscope, there's no issa. If you can see it, it's forbidden, irrelevant to its size. What? If that little speck would start running on the fruit, would you notice it? Then you're not allowed to eat it. Yes?
If there's an OU or a dot in the jelly,
okay, OU. Let's talk a bit about the OU kashrus. The OU have done something incredible in America by allowing any Jew, any place that wants to eat something with a kashrus to eat OU. OU, though, is a problematic kashrus from the point of view of people who want to be makbid. Why? The OU are already so big, they are unable to control everything that's under their wings. It's so much so that in many factories, they don't even have mashgiach. They merely get a list from the owner of the factory, and according to that list, they decide whether to give him a kashrus or not. Any Jew that eats OU is eating kosher food. Someone who wants to be more makpid should try and refrain from eating the OU, since they're better kashruyot. And again, we're not saying that the OU was created not as a kashrus for God-fearing from people. It was created as a kashrus for every single Jew that can have kosher food around America. So again, First of all, if you have something only the kashrus of OU, you can get something with a better kashrus, get something with a better kashrus. It means it was supervised better. If you find a jelly of jam, a can of jam, sorry, which, or jelly, that says on it, the kashrus of Badat say the chavir is strawberry, yes, you are allowed to eat it, there's no problem. Yes? Very good. We're told here that there are certain prides of the OU that are considered to be excellent, and one can ask people who understand in those kashas, for example, the Gaon of Nasan Maimon Shlita, one can ask him, he lives in America, and he knows what the good kashas are, what the products are, one can ask him. Again, we're not talking about the products, and we're not saying that the OU is not a kashas. All we're saying is that just like if you're going to buy now a car, you would want to get the best car that you could get, so too in kashrus. Try and get the better kashrus that you can get. The OU's problem is just they've become too big. They're unable to really control the system. It's kosher, but it's already too much. Yes?
When you were mentioning about detail, 10% of, say, pistachios or strawberries, now, you have to make sure that all 10 do not contain any insects whatsoever.
Exactly.
Okay, so if you do 9 strawberries, the 10th one has insects, another 10.
Very good. Good question. What happens if I took 10% and in that 10% I did found insects? Then I've got to do another checkup of another 10%. And if again in the other 10% it came out that again I found an insect or two, then I've got to open every single one out separately. Those 10% have to come out clean. If they don't come out clean, that means your statistical checkup did not work. Yes? Oh, if you bite out something, a good question. I took a bite into something and I can taste this foul taste. I feel as if it's infected or there's an insect in it and I spit it out. Did I do any issa? The answer is no. If you spit it out, there's no issa whatsoever, but you still have to do tshuva that you didn't check it before you put it into your mouth. Why is an insect so much worse? Why is an insect considered to be so bad concerning, let's say, to a pig? A pig, which is a rather revolting animal, is only considered to be one love. Why is a little insect considered to be so much more severe? There are two main reasons for the severity of insects. Reason number one, and this is a reason given by the Baalei HaMusar, the Torah wants to teach us that size is no issue whatsoever. Small things can be devastating. Big things can be meaningless. So insects teach us that the smaller it is, the worse it gets. But there is another reason given by the poskim why are insects considered to be so bad. Insects are considered to be one of the lowest and most basic life forms that exist in nature. They're very basic. Many insects are, they consider them to be, from a scientific point of view, built geniusly, of course, since Hashem designed everything. But insects are considered to be of very, very basic build. If you take an insect and you look at its internal systems and compare it to an animal is much, much more developed than an insect. We know that the lower you go on the levels of creation, the more the ability of tumah is to grasp onto it. That's why insects, which are much lower life forms than animals, are considered to be much worse. Okay?
Regarding the fish that you said.
Yes. What fish?
Fish have worms.
Fish. We will, with the help of Hashem, dedicate a private share on fish. If we can, we'll also bring pictures to explain what's the problem with fish. Fish are very problematic. Only get fish of a good kashrus.
Even if the worm is.
We will explain the whole issue of fish and the problems of worms. Yes? Box of cereal, it depends what cereal. Sometimes boxes of cereal might have very unwelcome guests in it. It all depends. Normally one doesn't have to suspect. Again, if it has a good kashrus, then the cereal is clean. But if you're buying something that is not a good kashrus, so if you just now went and bought oatmeal from the market, and you bought it, came in open cans, and you just filled out a bag of a kilo, you have got to check the oatmeal just like you check rice before you eat it. You've got to put it on a very, very bright surface. By the way, when you check rice, you do not put rice on a white surface. And the reason is because many of the insects that infect rice are white in color. So you can't see them on a white surface. You're supposed to use something which is light in color, but which is not white. I use something which is light brown, or the best thing to use is something which is light orange, where the insects really stand out. You can go to any single store, and you can get there a sheet of plastic of orange and use that to check for insects. Don't use something white. So if you buy oatmeal from the market, spread it out, make sure that it's clean, put it back into the bag. Yes?
In terms of oranges, the eggs on the outside.
What are we going to do about them? Okay, oranges have got a problem of insects which in Hebrew are called knimot and knimot magen. Knimot are small insects and knimot magen are shield insects. They secrete this fluid around their body which eventually hardens and it causes this dome, a cap, on top of the insect. So you can't even see the insect from the outside. When you look at it, these things normally affect oranges, lemons, pomelas, and grapefruits. Now, you will see it. It will look, the citrus family. It will look like this outer dirt. Now, many times, these are insects which have a shell on top of them, and you can't see them. If you would take a knife, and you would cut at the bottom, and turn it upside down, and look, you would see an insect hiding in. What that means is that normally we peel oranges before we eat them, unless of course you have some very weird sense of taste and you like to bite into the peel itself. Even if you peel them, the best thing to do is if you see an orange which is very dirty, wash it under the water before you peel it. And if you didn't do that, once you peel it, wash it again under water, because many times if you didn't peel it and it was infected on the outside, you will pass all the insects onto the inside part of the orange, which makes it very problematic. So oranges too should be cleaned before you eat them. And again, these are only dirty oranges. Yes?
In our class that we have in the afternoon, the English speakers, there was a mock locus in one of the safers about the tomato juice. It said, according to the Safari concept, it's a chef call. And I remember from learning Brooklyn's in America,
okay, what is one bench on tomato juice? It could be relevant for Tu B'Shvat, since that could be a wonderful thing to drink on the Tu B'Shvat table. Tomato juice is problematic. Why is it problematic? The question is, where did the juice come from what kind of tomatoes? And we'll explain why. If we're talking here about tomatoes that are used for normal growth, which are meant to be in the market to eat the tomato whole, but some of those tomatoes were taken to use for tomato juice, then the brocha is shehakol, because the main purpose of the tomato is for eating the actual fruit itself. The secondary use was to make out of it juice. One of the differences between Eretz Yisrael and America is that in America the tomato juice industry is very big. In Israel it's very small. In Israel normally the tomatoes that are used here in Eretz Yisrael are normal tomatoes sent out to the market to eat them as a normal vegetable. Therefore the bracha here in Eretz Yisrael will normally be shehakol. In America this is a much bigger industry and they also use special species of tomatoes which have gotten them lots of juice and very, very thin outer peels. These are things which are specifically grown for the purpose of the tomato juice industry. Therefore, their bracha would be Borei Pri HaAdamah, because the purpose of the tomatoes here is not to be sent out to the markets to eat the actual fruit itself, but the purpose is for the juice. Cooking has got no issue whether it changes the bracha from shehakol of adoma. The question is, what was the purpose that this was grown for? That is also a discussion that Poskim discuss about oranges. We know that we make a bracha on orange juice, shehakol niyo bedvara. Why? Because normally oranges are grown for the actual fruit itself, and only the orange juice is a secondary reason. What happens with places that grow the oranges only for the purpose of orange juice? it causes a big problem. Because according to many poiskim, you've now got a bench on it, boria pri haetz. Because that is the main purpose of orange juice. So again, that is probably a difference between what you saw in your shiur, between the book that was brought here in Eretz Yisrael and the book that was brought in America. Another example, pizza. But Pinchas Chaim Scheinberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, says there's a big difference between eating pizza in America and eating pizza here in Eretz Yisrael. Why? In America, pizza is considered to be a snack. It is not considered to be a meal. Therefore, he says, again, that's what Pinchas Chaim Scheinberg writes in a book. In Eretz Yisrael here, you will see families going to the pizza shop and the whole family will have a supper or a lunch of pizza. Since it is considered to be pizza, that means that it has a din of pat haba b'kisni, which means if you eat more than two slices, even though the pizza itself is very sweet, or the dough was put together with milk, nevertheless, if you eat more than two slices, you have to make hamoitzi and berkas hamazon. But Reb Pinchas Chaim Scheinberg writes that this is an Eretz Yisrael. In America, where pizza is always considered to be a snack, you don't go to the pizza shop to eat a meal of pizza. You go to have a pizza snack. And again, that's what he writes. I've never been to America. I don't know. Even in America, he says, over two pieces, you don't make a bracha birkas hamazon, and you don't make a moitzi, you will only make mezoinus and alamichya. So, I'm just, no, I didn't want to go into pizza. I just gave this as a difference to show. Very possible that things in America have changed from the time Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg wrote what he wrote. Maybe now in America pizza has become an actual food. People eat pizza. He gives another example, burekas. There's a big difference between small burekas and big burekas. If you eat a big burekas, you're planning to make that as your meal. Small burekas is a nash. So we can see here every in brachas, you can see how complicated and intricate Hilchos Brachos are. You've got to make sure in what country are we talking about. A book written in Eretz Yisrael is not always relevant for America. Any more questions about the worms and the insects? Yes?
Just applesauce. If you have applesauce, it's a problem. You can't see
fruit. Good question, which was also relevant to Tu Bishvat and eating fruits. When does the bracha, if I take something and I grind it, and I grate it, and I mush it, when does the bracha stay boya pri haetz? When does the bracha change to shakol? The ruling is, and this is the main ruling is that if you can see still a certain resemblance to the original fruit, the bracha is the original bracha. For example, if I now take, I'll give an example about egg salad, and then we're saying about applesauce. Egg salad, there's two ways of doing it. You can do what's called a thick grating and a thin grating. If you do applesauce in a thick grating, which means that there are still pieces of the apple inside the applesauce, and you can see that this was an apple once, the bracha is boya pri haetz. But if you grind it, and you would not know what it is, I could tell you, I could put it in a Gerber can, and I could write on it applesauce, I could write on it banana sauce, I could write on it pear sauce, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference because it just looks like this liquidy form of something, then therefore the bracha on that would be shehakol niyavidvoro, unless we're talking about special apples that were grown specifically for the purpose of applesauce. So again, we've got to check and everything. We now start realizing how complicated Hilchos Brachos are. Every single thing has got to be checked. What was the purpose? Yes?
Regarding what you said earlier about the bugs being low, being able to farm with someone, how would that be different than what the lettuce growing on the ground, or the vegetables that grow on the ground?
What's the difference between bugs and lettuce? Lettuce are not considered to be from the living world. They're considered to be from something from the tzomech. Tzomech, which is plants. There's a big difference between the world of chai, things that are considered to be animals, things that have got to consider to be live, and things that are considered to be growths or different plants. A very, very, very big difference from the point of view of the Kabbalic reasoning. Yes?
In dates, what should we look for in the
dates? We explained about dates. What one should do is, one should open the date.
What?
No, that was a date. I got it. With a date, you take a date, you slice it, you open it. You take out the pip, you make sure the inside part is clean. After that, you take the date, you hold it up to a source of light to make sure there's nothing stuck on the outside that you can't see. If that's the case, you can eat the date freely. Yes?
The seder of brachas
Say the brachas. This will be our last question. What is the order of the brachas? Generally, we have a ruling which is called maga'esh. What is maga'esh? Maga'esh represents any brachas. Mem stands for mezoinus. We first of all bench mezoinus. Gimel stands for gefen. Then bore pri ha-gefen. We bench on the wine. After that, we have ayin. Ayin is etz. We bench boire pri ha-etz. And in boire pri ha-etz, if we have here two fruits, one of them is from the seven species that Eretz Yisrael is blessed with, and one isn't, we should preferably make the bracha on those seven species. And in the seven species themselves, we also have a rating. The closer they are to the beginning of the pasuk, the more important they are. Which means, the pasuk says, Eretz chita usora, so chita usora not relevant. Eretz chita usora, vegefen utena verimon. Gefen is three, tena, which is a fig, is four, rimon, pomegranate is five. And then it says, Eretz zavat chalav, Eretz zeit shemen udvash. And a land with olives, which is first to the Eretz, and dates. So the order with fruit should be like this. Olive, dates, figs, sorry, olive, dates, grapes, figs, pomegranates. That is the internal order. But if you have, for example, here, a date or an apple, bench on a date. Then, we said, maga'esh, aleph, is adoma. After you make the bracha, boya pri ha'etz, then boya pri ha'adoma. For example, strawberries, bananas, etc. The last thing is shin, shehakol. Things that their bracha is shehakol, like meat, or fish, or a cup of water, that's the last bracha. Thank you very much. This was a relatively long shir. Be'ezrat Hashem will be meeting again next week, Thursday, between 11:30 and 12:30, to our weekly shir on Jewish halacha and minhag here on Breslev Israel, breslev.co.il. Thank you very much, and have all of you a wonderful, wonderful Tu B'Shvat.